One of the reasons that some people stay away from church and stay away from God is they have this conflict in their mind that not only is God no fun, but if you're going to try to be holy, if you're going to try to be with God, you can't be happy. So there's like this tension. It's like, well, I really want to be happy, but I still want to be with God. I want a sense of holiness in my life, but they don't coexist. I mean, it's impossible to be holy, be with God, and be happy. So one of the reasons we do the videos and the humor and stuff here is to say, you know what, really, here's the truth. Being happy and being with God can happen. I know for some people, they look into the future and think, well, I'd like to be with God, but I have to ditch all my happiness if I go that direction. I'm going to be around people that look like they work in a morgue, and, you know, it's just going to be no fun. I have to give up everything. And Jesus was facing the exact same thing when he came to earth and he started to talk to people about what it was like to be with God. Because in his culture, everybody had already decided, there's no way I'm going to be happy. I mean, I have to go to church all the time. I have to keep all these rules. I have to make sure that I measure up to all the different things that the church says. And I have to sort of check my brain at the door because I can't believe any of the contemporary thinking. And I just sort of have to be a religious robot. And so people were like leaving the church in droves in his day. Because they're like, well, I want to be happy. It's not that I don't want God, but like everything they saw said, there's no way I can be happy. And Jesus comes up in like a different message altogether. He says, well, really, it's quite possible to have fun and be happy and be with God. And he started to get people's attention with just that very simple message. Like, it's okay to like God wants you to be happy. And these crowds started gathering. And at first they're like, oh, come on. Like, really? But as they watched him live and as they listened to the things that he talked about, they found out really it's possible to be happy and to be holy. Now look here, there's a big idea this weekend. Jesus is committed to you. So every weekend we have the big idea and the big idea is that, like seeing a lot of churches, here's where it goes. They'll talk to you about all the different things that you need to do to show your commitment to God, or all the different hoops that you have to jump through to prove that you're going to be committed to God. So it all starts out with, hey, here's all the rules and the regulations and the standards, and here's all the different things that you have to do and you have to be if you're going to have a relationship with God. And Jesus said, boy, that's the number one way to not be happy. And he starts to have a groundswell with this very simple thought. What if the first thing you need to understand is that God is committed to you? Before you start to think about how you show your commitment, before you even go to the place of trying to decide what are all the things you need to do, what if the place to begin is to find out what has God done for you? What if the place to begin is to understand that God is committed to you before you attempt to be committed to him? And so he tells them this story because, you know, people are scratching their head as they're listening to Jesus. They're like, well, they didn't ever tell me this in church. And they're a little bit suspicious. And so he tells them a story. And let's look at it. I'll read it to you. So here he is. He says, there was a man who had two sons. I have two sons. So I relate to this story. Two very, very different sons. I love them both the same. You watch them grow up and you're like, whoa, man, you guys are very, very different. You think differently. You're very, very different. I have two sons, so I relate to this story. And there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, so here's the younger brother, you know how they are. The younger one says, father, give me my share of the estate. So he divides the property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of the country who sent him to feed his pigs, sent him into the field to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I'll set out and go back to my father and say to him, father, so here's his little speech, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of the hired men. So he got up and he went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. And that's the sentence to circle. Filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." He brushes him aside and says, "But the father said to the servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead. He's alive again. He was lost and he's found.'" So they began to celebrate. So, you know, like all families are sort of complex and there's different personalities and it's all sort of mixed together. And that's how it is in this family. The older son, we'll talk about him next week. The older son, he's the rule follower and he's very concerned with the image of the family. So I don't know if your family had an image and there was like one child or one parent, very, very concerned on how the family looks to everybody else. And they're sort of the keeper of the family image. Well, that's the older brother. He's like, make sure everybody thinks the right thing of the family. And he keeps all the religious rules. And he's like, I'm the perfect son and I'm the perfect brother. And, you know, he's that guy. Now, the younger one, he's not anything like that. He doesn't even care about image. In fact, he's happy to be the rebel. He's that guy in the family. He's like totally okay with that. So you have these two brothers growing up. And finally, the younger brother goes to his father and says, "Listen, I can't wait for you to die. I mean, I need my money now. I've got places to be. I got things I got to do. Go ahead and, you know, do whatever you have to do. But whatever I've got coming, give it to me now. Wants it right now." And if you're a parent, like you've maybe seen your children, they always got to have it now. Give it to me now. Give it to me now. Give it to me early. Like, he can't wait. He's like, "I want it right now. And, you know, I don't want to wait till I'm 16 to drive. I want to drive when I'm 11. And I don't wait till I'm 21 to drink. I want to, like, drink now. I want to, like, tell my parents I'm going to the movies with my friends. But actually, we're going to my friends whose parents have left for the weekend. And we got someone to buy us a sixer, you know, and we're 14. You know, it's like, I want to drink now. And I want to be with a boy now. And I want to get a girlfriend now. And I want to, like, have sex now." It's like, it's always early. I mean, and I was like that. I couldn't wait for anything. I mean, as I grew up, I was always pushing, you know, pushing. I want to do it now. And here's what I later realized as I look back. I was in so many situations that I was not mature enough to handle because I had to have it now. So I got myself into all kinds of certain, you know, and I wasn't old enough to handle those situations. I didn't have good judgment. I didn't know how far to go. I didn't know what really the long range results would be. And so I'm like into this stuff way, way early. And then I paid a price later because I couldn't wait. I had to have it now. So that's this guy. "Give it to me now, Dad." And I'm sure the crowd that's listening, they're like going, "Oh, no way." Because in this culture now, the rule in family was only the oldest son got any of the inheritance. All the inheritance went to the older son. That's how the families worked. And so nobody else got anything. But this family and this father is different. He must have had some arrangement with his younger son and said, "Our family is going to be different." And I just want you to know, Jesus is trying to say, God's family is different. It's different than the other families. And I know that some of us come from very hard circumstances in our families. So when someone said to you at some point, "Welcome to the family of God," you're like, "That's not good news to me." It's like, I didn't have a great life in my family. It wasn't easy in my family. It's like, you know, that's the good news? I get to be in a family? Or someone says, "God is your father." You're like, "That's not good news to me. It wasn't to me. I didn't even know my father. I didn't have a father growing up." So someone came and says, "God is just like a father." I said, "Oh, that's the guy that doesn't care. It's a person that's never with me." Jesus tells a story for everybody that's been in that situation and says, God's family is different. A different type of family. He doesn't run it like the other families. So if you've like had a resistance towards God, you're like, "I don't know." You know, it's like, I don't want to get into that again. I just want you to hear this. Please hear this. His family's different. He didn't run it like the other families. He's fair in his family. And the younger son says, give it to me now. Give it to me now. And you have to ask yourself the question, doesn't this seem like bad parenting? He's like, why does he give him the money? You're thinking, are you cracked or on crack? Or what are you thinking? I mean, you don't hand the credit card and the keys and say, you know, go do it. I mean, it seems like kind of bad parenting. Give me all the money now and now. He's like, okay, great. You know, he gives him the money. And you're like, and here's why. God doesn't try to control you. It might be an exaggeration in the story, but Jesus wants to make his point. God's not going to try to control you. The most special thing there is about you is that you were designed to be free. The best thing about you is you get to choose. And so the Father plays it out. He says, you're free to choose if you want to be with me or not. I told you I'd give you the money. Here's the money. One of the reasons we don't try to control anybody at East Lake Church is because God doesn't. We try to get as close as we can to how he does things, and you watch him, he just doesn't try to control people. He's not interested in relationships with puppets, religious robots. And so he gives him the money. Now let's see how the story goes. I mean, we'll play it out a little bit. Number one, make unselfish choices. So, you know, give it to me now, give it to me. And what it says is not long after that. So he gets the money. He doesn't stay around a long time. I mean, he gets the money together and he's gone. He's like, you know, he's like not long after that. I mean, there's not a lot of, I mean, he's just out of here. And you have to wonder how this father would have felt to have his son just get the money. He's like, thanks, Dad, and catch you later. When my family, my grandparents were the ones that always saved the day. All my life, my grandparents were always there for me. And one of the things they would do is they would drive a long distance to another city and they would pick me up and they'd bring me to their house for the weekend. And so this went on ever since I was a little tiny boy and on and on and on. And then when I became a teenager, there was this family in the neighborhood where they lived and they would buy their kids alcohol. And so I had this buddy, and he was my friend, and all of a sudden, they're buying alcohol. It's, well, as long as you drink it in the house here, you know. It's like, we were young, you know. It's like, but they did. And so, I was down for that, you know. I was like, I want to try alcohol too, you know. And so when my grandparents would come and pick me up, and they'd bring me to their house, all these years, I'd always hang out with them, and we'd play cards, and it was a great time. But then my friends, like, come on over, man. We got some beer. And what started happening is when I would go to my grandparents' house for the weekend, I'd kind of hang around for a couple minutes and I'd get antsy. I'd say, I want to go over to so-and-so's house. Well, you just got here. Aren't we going to do something? Oh, well, I'll be back pretty soon. And before long, I was ditching them every time I came. Because I had to get over to that other house, man, because that's where the action was at. And I never even realized how bad I hurt them. It didn't even occur to me. It's like I had some beer to drink. And I just would leave. And it was many years when I looked back. And I thought, gosh, I never even thought about them. How that might made them feel. And that's what this son is like. It's very selfish. He's like, just, I'm gone. And it says he goes to a distant country. And here's why. You'll always put distance between yourself and the people that you really don't want them to see how you, like, you actually live. Like, he knows, he's like, I don't want everybody in my family to see what I'm really about and how I really live. So he goes a long, long ways away, which is very confusing for family, because family's like, why are they so distant now and everything? Don't they like me anymore? And why? How is everything different between us now? And you don't realize that the reason they're distant is they don't want you to see how they really live. So you come up with all kinds of ideas why they don't want to be with you, and none of them are right. Usually we blame ourselves. And really all the sun is I need a lot of distance because I don't want anybody to see how I'm living. When I was 19 years old, I wanted some distance from everybody. So I got a backpack and everything I had, and I left for Hawaii. Now I'm going to tell a story on myself that I'm not proud of, but I want you to kind of get it and know that this was a long time ago. So if you can't handle that kind of honesty in church, then you have to find another place to go to church. So here's what it was. So 19 years old, and like, where am I going to go? So I decided to go to Hawaii because I heard that they had the best weed. Now when that's the reason you make your choices, you know you're heading for problems. And that was me. So I go to Hawaii. I don't know one soul in Hawaii. And I'd heard of, this is going to date me, but I heard of Maui Waui. It was, I guess, this special type of weed that you could get that I just had to have some. So I leave for Maui. I don't know anybody. I arrive in the airport and, you know, Maui Waui. Everything. I've got no plan. And, a friend of mine had said they don't hitchhike there, but if you just stand alongside the road, somebody will come and pick you up. So here I'm going now, and I'm standing alongside the road, and this guy comes up to me in an old Volkswagen Bug, and he's like, Ross, he's got the hair going every which way, and he tells me to get in the car with him. You want to ride? If you go to Hawaii, like Maui, you can't understand the locals. I don't know what they speak, but it's not English. So anyways, he's like, come on inside. So I get into the car, and somehow he gets a point across to me that he has some weed that we can smoke together. You know, the Maui Wowie. So, like, this guy's amazing, too. He's ambidextrous. He's, like, driving with his knee like this, and he's rolling this joint like this, you know. It's like, music's going, his hair's flying back and everything. And I'm thinking, dang, you know. So he gets the joint rolled up, and he gives it to me. Now, I had never smoked anything really of any, like, high value, because I'm from Nevada. So by the time, like, pot gets to Nevada, it's like a bale of straw hay. I mean, it's, like, hardly potent. So he gives me this Maui Wowie thing in a joint. And I take a couple of hits off that thing, like, it's like, well, that wasn't bad, huh? Imitation. But anyways, okay, so that's what I do. And now it's like, bam, that thing hits me. I couldn't believe it. You've never really been through this before, probably, but I had. It's like you're listening to a radio in a car and you can barely hear it. And then you take a couple of hits off some stuff like that, and it's like you're at a concert. I mean, the music is filling that thing, and it's just the colors all vibrant, and, you know, I'm like, whoa, this is unbelievable. And I'm looking at the waves out the window. I've never seen the ocean before. And later, I saw that they were only about this high, but to me, it was Hawaii 5-0. They were coming up, you know, it's just unbelievable. I'm like, man, I'm in Hawaii with Maui Wowie. He says, do you want to buy some? I said, buy some right now, you know. Take my wallet out of my backpack and give him the money. And he just 2 seconds later, he stops the car. I said, well, what's going on? He says, you're getting out. You know, I was like, whoa, okay. You know, so I jump out of the car and grab my backpack, and I'm walking down, and I decided I wanted to check my, you know, see how much money I had. And that's when I realized I'd left my wallet in his car. So I just started running as fast as I could. I don't know, like, I was going to, I mean, well, you're high. It's so stupid. He's been gone for 5 minutes, but I'm going to catch him. You know, so I'm running as fast as I can down this road. And as I'm running, I see a policeman up in front of me. And I think, well, that guy can help me. So I go running up to the policeman as fast as I can. Hey, man, this is really big things happened, man. This guy picked me up in his, like, his little Volkswagen. And I left my wallet in his car. I had taken my wallet out. And the policeman says, well, why did you have your wallet out? And I'm like, never mind. You know, and so, you know, I tell you that story for this reason. One, to say, well, to give you a glimpse of what it's like in your life when you decide to do wild living. See, you just because you create distance from people, you still go through whatever wild living causes for you. Because it says that it cost him all his wealth with wild living. And it will cost you. There's a saying that sin will take you further than you want to go, that it'll keep you longer than you want to stay, and it'll cost you more than you want to spend. And so he gets a lot of distance. Nobody can see me now. And still, you know what? Like, life plays out. Life played out when I had to call home and say, get me an airline ticket the same day I got there. I have to come home now. Thought you were going to live in Maui forever. Well, it actually didn't work out. Because the distance doesn't matter. It'll still cost you people's respect. It'll still cost you your own self-respect. It doesn't matter how much distance there is. And so, like, you know, when you're thinking about, like, how to live your life and you're wondering, well, how is this going to go down? One thing you need to know is that it doesn't matter how much distance it is. If you create a lot of distance, it'll selfish choices will still play out. Now, the second thing is turn your notes over. Overcome your mistakes. So here he is now, you know, he's like wild living. It's cost him a lot. And now he starts to figure out, because here's what happens to him. And this is the craziest part of it, is he's Jewish. So he's been raised his whole life. Don't go around pigs. Don't touch pigs. Don't eat pigs. You have nothing to do with pigs. And now the only job he can get is to be a pig farmer. And it's the time in your life where you all of a sudden realize, I'm doing something that I never thought I would do. And distance won't help that not happen either. So you can hide from people. You can put a lot of distance from people. You can do all of that. And here he is now. And here's what he's saying to himself. Whoa. I never thought that I would do this. I mean, it cost him his self-respect. What still bothers you in your life because you never, ever thought you'd go that low? But you did. And you thought, well, as long as nobody sees me and knows what I'm doing and nobody can see what's going on and everything, I'll be good. And then it happens, and now in your heart you're like, God, I never thought I'd do that. I never thought I'd let them do that to me. I never thought I would do that to anybody. That's this Jewish guy. He's like, gosh, I'm with pigs? No way. And the scripture says that's when he came to his senses. You know, a lot of times we think when we're making big mistakes, well, if I can just get this mistake ironed out and get it all settled and nobody knows what happened, once I get it all ironed out, then I'll walk with God. You know, then I'll do the right things. I just got to get this all settled and then I'll do it. But this story, it says right when he's with all the pigs. Listen, the best time, you can't get through a mistake. You can't overcome a mistake until you admit it. Never going to happen. Until you admit a mistake. So you admit it's a mistake, you can't overcome a mistake. And the best place to do it is when you're right there in the pig pen. I mean, there you are. You're just right in the middle of the whole thing. This is a mistake. Whoa. And of course, you want to, you really want to be able to tell yourself the truth. You want to be able to tell other people the truth. He starts rehearsing this speech. Oh, I know I've sinned. And we know he must have had something go on with God because all of a sudden now he's concerned with heaven. He's like, oh man, how did this? Here's God's attitude. Well, you're in the pig pen. I guess that's where I'm going to be now too. You go play with the pigs, God goes plays with the pigs because he's completely committed to you. You end up with the pigs. You end up doing something you thought you never, ever would do. Well, then God's with you there. He starts to be able to admit the truth to himself. And think about, once you admit it to yourself, maybe you can admit it to someone else. He's thinking about, well, maybe I can tell my dad the truth. And number three in your notes, change your direction. Because that's what he decides. He's like, okay, I cannot even believe that in the middle of all this mistake, I think I feel God's presence. Some of you don't feel God's presence because you don't want to go there. You don't want to admit that you're with the pigs. Oh, I'm not actually with the pigs. I just like pigs. They're like pets. I'm just kind of hanging out with them today. It's a petting zoo. But it's not true. And God's with the pigs, and that's where you'll feel his presence. So many times we're like, I don't want to admit any mistakes, but oftentimes it's in the middle of your mistakes, that's where you feel God's presence. And so he finally starts to admit it, and he decides he's going to change his direction, which isn't easy to do when you get stuck with the pigs. And then go back and see his father. And he's got this little speech all planned out. He's like, I know I did some bad sins, God. And then he says to his father, I'm not worthy to be called your son anymore. So you can just like make a mental note. He's half right and half wrong. He's right. Some pretty big sins against heaven. But really wrong that he's not worthy to be called a son. Because God is completely committed to you. His commitment is not on the basis of your character. It's on the basis of his own. So he has himself all convinced. And a lot of times the reason I don't want to admit my mistake, when I became a new Christian, I was making all kinds of mistakes. Like it's like I came into Christianity very un-Christian. And so I was making all these mistakes. And someone said to me one time, said, Robin, you're making lots of mistakes, but you're not a mistake. And boy, that went right into my heart, man. I needed to hear that so bad. Because I had racked up years of mistakes. To the point that I felt like a mistake. And I said, you're making lots of mistakes, but you're not a mistake. There's a building in Houston that became pretty famous. It's a big skyscraper. and it's everything's fine in the building now. But when they built the building, the whole shell of the building was up. They built all the floors. They got everything done. And then, like, towards the end of it is when now they're going to deck out the building. The electricians come in and fix everything, and they paint the walls, and they put all the cabinets and the counters and the bathrooms, and they lay the carpet. They get it all ready for people, right, the last part of it. So the building's up. If you looked at, oh, the building's done, but it's not done because they have all this stuff they have to do on the inside. And as this building is like, they got all the subcontractors in there, and everybody's coming in, and, you know, the people are going to do the granite on the counters. And everybody's struggling with all of their jobs. The painter and the carpets doesn't seem like it's fitting correctly, and the stuff's not matching, and in the bathrooms it's not fitting right. It's all been ordered. They can't get the cabinets up, and now they're starting to quarrel amongst each other because nothing is going in correctly in this building. And now the subcontractors are all fighting. It's your fault. You didn't put the wall up right. It's not my fault. I know I didn't. They're all quarreling, and finally they went back and they researched, and this is what they found out. These skyscrapers, they put a center line in the very beginning. And it's meticulously placed. And once that's placed, everything is built in conjunction. Everything is built in alignment with that center line. And when they had marked it, they missed it by 1 inch on the plans. True story. So everything in the building was off by an inch. The cabinets were an inch too short. The carpet was an inch too long. The electrical wiring was an inch too short. They were an inch too far to the right or the left. Everything was wrong because the center line was wrong. And sometimes in life, that you get that way with God. You just have like one thing and it's off with God and everything gets crazy. He has one thing. Here it is. I can get kicked out of God's family. I can be someone that's disowned by God. And maybe you've known someone, or maybe you are someone, you've gone through that, and like some big things are going on in your family, and either it's a hint or they sort of let you know, it's like, hey, if you go that direction, you're not in the family anymore. And maybe you've been hurt by that. Or maybe they don't say it, but they live it. And you lose your place in the family. And that's what he believes about God. He's like doing pretty good. He's like, I know I'm not doing good. I got to go back and do it. But his center line is, it'll never be the same between me and God again. And that's where he's off. Totally misses it. Now look at the fourth thing. Accept God's love. So here's what's happening now. So he's like, he decides he's going to go back. Here goes the boy. He's going back. He takes off and he's repeating the speech to himself. I'm sure he's saying it over and over again to himself. I know I've sinned a lot against you, God, and I'm really, really sorry for that. And Dad, I know everything's jacked up in my life. And could I just get a job? I mean, that's his hope. Would I just be able to have a job? I'll hang out in the bunkhouse with the guys. So he's repeating to himself, And all of a sudden he looks and he sees, no way. Is that my dad? And his dad is running towards him. Yeah, I know he's got to be thinking, oh, man, I knew it was going to be bad. But he's not even going to let me get to the house. He doesn't want anybody to see me. He's not even going to let me get home before he's going to tell me, get the heck out of here. Sees his dad running. He's probably thinking, man, what relationship do you have and you've never done anything yet to try to repair it? Because what you think is, it is going to go so bad. And then you go try, and right off the bat, it seems like it's going way worse than I even thought. That's this boy. Here comes his dad running. And in the Middle East now, remember, that culture, dignified, like patriarchal culture, the fathers don't run. You know, but somehow he's got his toga thing or whatever they wear, and he's like running, like, you know, like running. So, and the son's thinking, oh, man, here it comes, you know. And when he approaches him, he grabs him, and he hugs him, and he kisses him. You know, he's got to be thinking, what? I don't deserve that. And so often I'm unable to receive God's love, even though he gives it, because I don't feel like I deserve it. After what I did Friday night, you mean God wants to love me? No way. After what I did to the last girl I did, after what I did at my work, I mean, it's like, I don't deserve that. And so he starts his little speech. His dad hugs him and kisses him, like, and he says, Dad, I've sinned against heaven and against you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And his dad just, like, pushes it aside. Nice speech, but I have a different plan. I guess a lot of people must have been running with him. Now, here's the crazy thing. In that culture, if you were a son that embarrassed your family like that, if that's what you did in that culture, they had a ceremony that they put you through. If you left your family and disgraced them like that, they had a ceremony all planned out for you when you tried to return. Oh, now all my money's gone and I got to go back to my family support. They had a ceremony. What they used to do when you got into town and you started to get close and here he's back now, huh? The father would gather all of his friends and all the relatives and anybody else that wanted to do it. And what they would do is they would come out and they would approach you and they would circle you, and the father would take a clay pot and he'd walk up to where you were standing and he'd smash it onto the ground. And then he'd pick up a piece of it and he'd say, "You broke my heart and you broke your family's heart and you broke promise with the people that you've lived with. This represents you and the brokenness that you caused. You don't belong in the family anymore." And then they would hand them that and they would force them out. So, you know, that son's probably thinking, "Oh, here he comes. He's going to run. He's going to do that." But here's what the father's thinking. "I got to get to him before the village does. I got to get to him before all the other people that are judging him. I've got to get there before, because everybody's assuming that we're going to do the big pot ceremony. I got to get to him first." And God wants to get to you first. He's willing to run. His heart was filled with compassion. Here's what I've noticed. And can you think of all the different things that this father's heart could have been filled with? Anger, rejection, resentment, "I'll get you back." I mean, that would have been a pretty natural thing to have in your heart. But instead, he has compassion in his heart. Here's what I've discovered. Compassion will always cause me to run towards those that have hurt me. Because you know what I naturally want to do? Run away from them. "I got to get to my son before the other people get to him, man. I got to get to him." And so they get like, and the son's like, now here's the good news, and write it in your notes. God will provide for your happiness. Here's the father. "Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and he's alive again. He was lost and he's found." So they began to celebrate. Think about this now. He's in the middle of a party. And this isn't like an order pizza party, you know, with Pabst Blue Ribbon. This is the good beer party. This is the good beer. And this is steaks and ribs and buckets of potato salad and no nasty vegetables to ruin the party. I mean, this is greasy food. And good food and ice cold soda and ice cold good beer and music and laughing, and they're all like going on. I mean, he throws a party. He finances a party. And I'm sure there was people that looked at it and said, "Are you crazy? After what he did to you?" And the father says, "I love my son." What? "He embarrassed you in front of everybody, man. And he took all your money. You're throwing him a party. I love my son. Look at him. He's a loser, man. He smells like pigs. You listen to me. I love my son." So he throws a big party so everybody knows. I don't want anybody to be unclear. He's like, "I don't want anybody to think I have any judgments. I don't want anybody to misunderstand what's going on between me and my son. So I'm throwing a party and it's an open party. Everybody gets to come because you need to know one thing. I love my son." Now here's the thing I wanted to ask. As I said when we began, do you think more about the commitments that you need to keep to God, or do you think more about the committedness that He lives in towards you? You think about, these are the things I have to do, and these are my commitments I have to keep to God, or are you willing to consider the commitment that God has to you? And you may be here tonight, and you may be like thinking about that. Well, that's like you relate to it. It's like, I understand what it is to be far from God and to think if I go back to God, it's like he's just going to tell me about all the bad things I do. He's break the pot at my feet and say, "You had your chance." And like he tells this story. And if you're here tonight, please hear it, man. He tells this story so all of us could say, that's how I'll be treated when I screw up? Seriously? That's why he told the story. Because he wanted people to know, God's committed to your happiness. Even better than that, he's committed to you. So the only question then becomes, really, do you want to be committed to him? So let's say a prayer. I'll say a prayer, and then we'll do a couple other things, and then we'll be done for the night. Thanks for the evening service tonight, Lord, and getting a chance to be here in church. But mostly, Jesus, that you're alive and that you consistently represent commitment to us from God. Then when we squander all our wealth on wild living, when we just ditch you to run out to have fun, you consistently look into the horizon with compassion in your heart, ready to run to us, ready to love us. I pray tonight for anybody in the room that's thinking, oh, that's just a story in the Bible. I don't really know if God will be that way. Then here's what I'm asking. Jesus, would you convince them that they're not alone? So look at me for a second. I want you guys to see something. I'm going to do a picture for you. So you're standing on the end of a high dive like this right here, and you're looking down, and you're just standing here like this. In this world, there's low-dive people and there's high-dive people. So I don't know which you are. Well, of course, there's the people that sort of walk in with the steps, and so I don't know who they are. But usually there's the low-dive people and there's the high-dive people. Now, in my family, I was the high-dive guy. And so I always would, as soon as I saw a swimming pool, we lived in a place where we had a public pool. My parents bought a little pool pass for us. Me and my sister would go there every single day and go swimming. And I was a high-dive guy. So I'd go up there, I'd get on the high-dive, and pew, I'd be go jumping off. You know, it was like, awesome. Now, my sister, she was a low-dive girl. So she'd go off a little low-dive, but she wanted to be a high-dive girl. And every single time we go to the swimming pool, all the way, oh, I'm going to go off the high dive today. Today I'm the high dive. I'm going to be a high dive girl. I was like, Melissa, don't do it again, please. Because here's what she'd do. She'd get to the high dive. She'd go up the ladder. She'd walk all the way out to the end, and she'd stand at the end. And as soon as she got there, she'd look down, and she'd be like, and she could not jump. Now you got people in line yelling, you get off the diving board, jump, go, girl, stupid girl, you know. There, my sister would be just like this. Do you know her? I was like, I've never seen the girl before. I don't even know who she is. And she'd be like this. And then sure enough, she'd take the rail and she'd inch back like this. And then she'd have to go down the ladder backwards. I'm like, oh, God, this is so embarrassing. And she'd enter, and every time, and I know why. Like when I was a kid, I didn't, but I know why now. Because when she was at the end of that board, looking down at that water, when she finally looked, she felt so alone. Do you know what this boy figures out when he's with the pigs? I'm not alone. I'm not alone. Grab your connection cards.